10:07.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In late October 1967, that means, in fact, 35 years ago this week, a young U.S. Navy pilot on a bombing run near Hanoi was hit. He ejected from his A-4 fighter, survived his fall into a nearby lake, and spent the next 5.5 years as a prisoner of war. John McCain returned to the United States and some 10 years later got himself into politics. From the Congress to the Senate, all the way up to a run for president. Not bad stuff for a story. And McCain has written it. Part one is the best-selling Faith of Our Fathers. Part two is his new book. It's called Worth the Fighting For. 40 years of public service. 40 years of looking for inspiration, examples, heroes. Funny thing is, one of the most compelling heroes in the life of Senator John McCain, as he tells it, is not even real. He's the fictional Robert Jordan in Ernest Hemingway's book For Whom the Bell Tolls. So when we heard that the senator from Arizona was going to be in town, we thought we'd ask him in for a chat, not necessarily about politics, not necessarily about Iraq or war or peace. We'll probably get to some of that. But we thought we'd start with For Whom the Bell Tolls. And Connection listeners, we invite you to join our conversation. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Senator, welcome to The Connection.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks for having me on.
Now, there's a story behind your discovery of this book.
I was 12 years old. I had found a couple of four-leaf clovers in the front yard of our house in Washington, and I went to press them in a book, and I grabbed a book off the shelf in my father's library and opened it up and was about to press it, and a passage of the book caught my eye, and I became engrossed, sat down, and read it from start to finish, and still, it probably is the most impactful event on me, and as far as shaping my thoughts, views, idealism, and my vision of what a hero is.
One of the parts of the passage that you read, if I'm correct, is that horrible description of the people who were called the Loyalists.
Yes.
Killing the fascists in the Spanish Civil War.
Who were the communists. Let me refresh our
history here. Yeah.
History. One of the bloodiest wars in history, a little war, was the Spanish Civil War. The communists on one side and the fascists on the other. And both were taken over by, in the case of the fascists, the Germans, and in the communists, the Russians, and they used it as a testing laboratory for their weapon systems. And, of course, the bloodletting was horrendous. 1% of the population, it was just incredible. And in the end, Franco won. But the interesting thing about the war was thousands of idealistic young Americans went to fight in the war on the side of the communists. I'm not sure because they were communists, but because they were so anti-fascist. They were called the Abraham Lincoln Brigades and the George Washington Brigades, and a lot of them died. And in this book, bringing us back to For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway went to Madrid and stayed in Madrid during the Spanish Civil War, from which came, I think, the great American novel. And it's about Robert Jordan, who happens to be from Montana, as I recall.
Missoula, Montana.
There you go. And his mission is to destroy a bridge to help an offensive that's going to be launched by the communist forces. And it's a failed mission in many respects, and the offensive is not going to succeed. And in other words, he's a man who's willing to sacrifice his life for what he believes in, even if what he believes in he realizes is flawed in many respects. Remarkable, remarkable story. And I was thrilled by him. Robert Jordan, when I read that book, was everything I ever wanted to be, including a wonderful love affair with a beautiful young Spanish girl named Maria.
Probably why it stayed on the high school reading list.
There's
a passage Hemingway writes when Robert Jordan is reacting to that horrible scene you've described. And he's thinking to himself, the first thing was to win the war. If we did not win the war, everything was lost. But he noticed and listened to and remembered everything. He was serving in a war, and he gave absolute loyalty and as complete a performance as he could while he was serving, but nobody owned his mind, nor his faculties for seeing and hearing, and if he were going to form judgments, he would form them afterwards, and there would be plenty of material to draw them from. There was plenty already. There was a little too much sometimes.
Too much, of course, meaning the excesses, the brutality, the way that the Russians really did co-opt that revolution, which started well-founded, egalitarian kind of motivation to... there's one passage in the story where he sends a messenger back to try to warn the headquarters that the fascists have anticipated the attack that's supposed to take place. And the guy ends up in one of these commissars' headquarters. And this commissar, who is just a brute, is just ordering everyone shot and killed, which is what happened, If you read, I'm trying to think of the author's name now. There's a definitive history of the Spanish Civil War. And the anyway, a lot of the brutality that was carried out by the Russian commissars in that conflict was as terrible as that inflicted by the fascists. And it got bloodier and bloodier and crueler, more cruel and more cruel, and to the point where I think it took the Spanish as a nation 50 years to recover from that.
But let me ask you something. Robert Jordan, as committed as he is to the cause, is questioning why he's there all the time. He's got serious doubts about the justice of his cause, but he sticks to it.
I think he feels that he committed to it. I think that, as you mentioned that passage, that at the end that maybe you can balance the best and the worst. But he also had an abiding dislike and fear of the fascists. In other words, even though he was supporting and willing to die for a flawed cause, he knew that the option of the fascists winning was far more severe than that one. And second of all, he was in. I mean, he was there. He had a mission, and that mission had to be accomplished, even though he knew, because the attack was being anticipated, that it didn't matter whether he blew the bridge or not as far as the balance of the conflict went, but he still had to carry out his mission, even at the risk and subsequent loss of his own life. And he did it stoically. At the end, the title of the book comes, he's sitting there behind his machine gun with his crushed leg, and he says, the world is a fine place and worth the fighting for, and I will very much hate to leave it.
You refer to that as almost psalm-like.
Yes.
P-S-A-L-M, psalm-like.
Yes. It is. It's a beautiful phrase when you think about it. And to me, it means everything. Maximize your time. Be associated with a cause greater than your self-interest. Care about the world, not just your own self. Care about the entire world, which is the opportunity that the United States has as a nation today, because we're the most powerful nation in history going back to the Roman Empire. And accept your fate. Accept your fate. You know, so many of us, particularly in politics, were not willing to accept our fate. My fate was, as much as I may struggle, was never to be president of the United States. And I have to accept that. You can look back in anger, and you can look back, you know, and think of all the real or imagined injustices. But you should look back with gratitude that you had the opportunity, particularly a guy who stood fifth from the bottom of his class at the Naval Academy, to prove that in America anything is possible.
Now, you've read this book a few times. A
number of times, yes, many times.
You didn't have a copy with you in the Hanoi Hilton.
No, but I thought about it a lot. I have good recall. You know, in a prison situation, there's some my fellow POWs who built houses or did mathematical formulas or, you know, depending on your bent of mind. I thought about the things I'd read and the movies I'd seen. And this book I thought of over and over and over and over again.
Is there a similarity between Jordan's own sense of the Spanish Civil War as a lost cause and Senator McCain's sense of Vietnam is the same?
You know, to be honest with you, Dick, I'd never thought about that, but there certainly is. Certainly that this cause, the way we conducted it anyway, was not going to succeed. And I think that's a good comparison. But what I thought about more than the nature of the conflict was the nature of the situation. I knew that Robert Jordan, if he were in the next cell to mine, he would be stoic, he would be strong, he would be tough, he wouldn't give up, and Robert would expect me to do the same thing.
Code is a word that comes up a lot in Hemingway's book. Mm-hmm. The code that rules anything from the sportsman, the hunter, mm-hmm. the warrior, the code of the warrior, lover, drinker, all those things that Hemingway wrote about in A Man's World were ruled by some kind of code. And the odd thing was that you refer to that as well in your new book. You talk about Teddy Roosevelt's code. You mm-hmm. talk about the code of conduct of the POW.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I think we all have to live by a certain code or set of ideals, or try to. In other words, I am a very flawed individual, and I've had many failings. And yet I've known, at least I've had the benefit or the curse of knowing what I should live up to. And that has been imbued in me by Robert Jordan and Ted Williams and Theodore Roosevelt and so many others that have inspired me in my life. And yes, there is a certain code, and that's why sometimes we have to rely on others to help us maintain it. I was an individualist all my life. I was a tough guy. I was pleased to be alone. I was ready to fight. But as I write in my book, if you don't have a cause to serve, then you're just a punk. And it took my time in prison, where I was dependent on others for my spiritual and physical well-being, to realize that really what this is all about is to serve a cause greater than your self-interest. When I read For Whom the Bell Tolls, I lost the lesson of Hemingway. Hemingway's title is from the famous poem, No Man is an Island Within Himself. And that's really the lesson of For Whom the Bell Tolls, rather than just some stoic, rugged individualist. I'm sorry for the long answer,
but you make an excellent point. You're talking about the rebel without a cause being just a punk. You're writing about Billy Mitchell at that point, who is one of your heroes.
Billy Mitchell had the vision of the efficacy of air power. I'm sure after the Afghanistan conflict, he is smiling broadly. He was willing to give up his entire career. He was willing, gladly, faced court-martial and thrown out of the United States Army in disgrace because he was willing to stand up for
Deputy Chief Army Air Services, this is the man who made the Air Force what it is today, just through force of will, is he not?
And fought against the admirals and proved that you can sink a battleship with an airplane. And, it was a great visionary. But he lost it all. And in those days, the military was small. Everybody knew each other. And to be in disgrace was truly to be in disgrace, a court-martial and being thrown out of the service. I mean, it's hard to imagine nowadays. All officers came from the Naval Academy or West Point.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Senator John McCain talks about codes, codes of honor, codes of loyalty. What the heck is this man doing in politics? 1-800-423-TALK is our number. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Arizona senior Republican Senator John McCain. We're talking about, in part, his new book, Worth the Fighting For, a little bit about Ernest Hemingway, For Whom the Bell Tolls. Just before we went away for a break, I made a little bit of a joke about honor and heroes in politics, and then got to thinking that this was a week in which a lot of people are acknowledging the commitment, the spirit of Senator Paul Wellstone, who was a friend of yours, and mm-hmm. perhaps appropriate to just
Yes.
Check in with you on that and see what you're thinking.
Could I make a comment about Hemingway to finish up our last conversation?
Sure can.
First, Hemingway had his flaws. Hemingway, you know, was kind of the ultimate macho, and there's been a great deal written about him. But I also believe that Hemingway had this incredible style of writing, which sort of set a new way of storytelling. And I think that despite his failings, he lived a full life and had a crowded hour, as Teddy Roosevelt put it. Paul Wellstone was a man who never forgot where he came from. Paul Wellstone never put on any airs of pretension. I've seen people come to the Congress of the United States and change a lot. Paul Wellstone was the same college professor that he was the day he was elected. He was kind and generous to all people in the Senate. The young lady that runs the elevator, the man, the African-American man that runs the subway, he loved the little people. And Paul Wellstone was an unabashed, passionate, and committed believer in a liberal philosophy, which is an important part of America's political debate. Paul Wellstone voted against the Iraq resolution. He was the only senator, United States senator, up for re-election to do so. And he told his wife that he knew that was going to hurt him politically. But he was willing, as my friend Russ Feingold was one time in one of his campaigns, willing to put it all on the line because he stood up for what he believed in. We'll miss him. He was a sweet man. A very sweet man, and I got to be quite friendly with him, as did most of us, because he never made his politics personal.
Is there a part of you that despairs that the chamber where you work and the city in which you have to learn to operate doesn't place perhaps the priority on those attributes for men and women that it should?
Yes, and I've seen quite often that when someone leaves the political scene, they are quickly forgotten. Your best friends no longer have your phone number or can take your calls. It's a very rough, cruel town. And as long as you understand that, then you can operate in it without being too disappointed. But anyone who comes to that town and thinks that you're going to make lasting friendships, they are very rare. Harry Truman said, you know, if you want a friend in Washington, go out and buy a dog. And I think Harry was correct. Now, Fred Thompson is a close friend of mine. Chuck Hagel is a friend of mine. Mike DeWine is a close friend of mine. I have several close friends. It's not that I'm without friends. But the way the place operates, the first thing you want to get is their respect. And then if you have their affection, then that's pleasant. And I say that with the full and certain knowledge that I will not be elected Miss Congeniality in the United States Senate again this year. But you've got to stand up for what you believe in, because when you leave, are you going to want to be judged by the friends you made or what you were able to accomplish? And yes, it helps to have friendship. But first, you've got to have the issue. And you've got to have the American people behind you. Then you'll be able to prevail. 8 years ago, when Russ Feingold and I embarked on campaign finance reform, we didn't have a snowball's chance in Gila Bend, Arizona. And we worked at it, and we fought for it, and we got the American people behind us. And that's why we were able to succeed. Now, we have many battles to fight on campaign finance reform. But getting legislation passed was something that no one anticipated when we embarked on it.
We could put that perhaps in the same column under heroic causes. Robert Jordan would say, stick to it. I mean, there must have been part of you thinking of that inspiration, even on that cause.
And someone said, why is it that it earned so much anger and even dislike from the part of your colleagues? Because we were attacking a system that keeps incumbents in office. We were actually attempting to destroy a system that is what reelects 90, 95, 98% of the members of Congress and the Senate. So we're a direct threat to them. That's why you've got this visceral emotion. You know, we're trying to take away someone's freedom of speech, you know. Freedom of speech. Since when is money speech? But anyway, we won't go into that. But when you understand that we were attacking a system that keeps incumbents in office, then you can understand the visceral reaction. And the millions of dollars that are made by the consultants, the millions and billions of dollars are made by the lobbyists on K Street, and frankly, all of those special interests that are able to get their influence over that of the people's interest through the present system. We alienated all of them.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to South Boston, Massachusetts. Eric's on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Hi, Eric.
It's an honor to speak with you, Senator.
Thank you, sir.
And even when I've been a longtime supporter, and even when I've disagreed on issues with you, I've always admired your integrity, which I think speaks toward the code of Hemingway that you're discussing today.
Thank you.
I have one sort of question, comment. I'm a novelist. I teach at BU, and this semester I taught some Hemingway, his short stories, but many of his themes remain the same. I got to thinking that much of his writing, the heroes, because of their stoicism, and much like those great men in reality, their stoicism is often misread as a lack of compassion rather than having compassion, but not always demonstrating or showing it outwardly, which was, had a great deal to do with the style too. And I wonder if you see that both in his interpretation of his writing, and also how some of the great men of our time and previous times might have been, their stoicism might have been mistaken for a lack of compassion or a lack of concern or caring.
You know, I think that's an excellent point, Eric. As we all know, probably his most famous short story, or one of his most famous short stories, was The Killers. And the whole theme of the very short story is that the Swede knows that the killers are going to come to get him, and that's okay. He's
right.
Tired of running, and you know that's the ultimate in Hemingway's stoicism. And yet, when you think about what made the Swede grow tired of running and the betrayal that he experienced from the woman he loved, then it's full of emotion and passion, and finally a willingness to recognize that there really isn't that much left of his life. Is that how you read it, Eric?
Yes, I do. And I think working with the iceberg principle, as Hemingway did it, that much of his writing, the compassion was there. You had to engage yourself as a reader.
Yeah, the snows of Kilimanjaro. He basically accepts that after fighting it, he accepts that he's going to go and finally see the body of the... was it a jaguar? What, I've forgotten which animal it was that lay above the snow line.
Snow leopard?
Was it snow leopard? I've forgotten.
Leopard, yes.
Yeah, leopard, yeah. And it's just, that's a common thread through his books. And yet I agree with you. The ones who are stoic are the ones that understand best all of the factors that contribute to that that attitude. And as I am a fatalist, but that doesn't mean that I don't struggle against the forces of fate.
Right.
Tell me if in your writing, your work with Mark Salter, who's helped you on both the books, it's you sit down and say, stylistically, you know, we want to try and keep this simple, straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of Hemingway wouldn't hurt. You know?
I think he obviously has deeply influenced me. For the benefit of our listeners, Mark Salter and I have been together for more than 13 years. We've worked together. He's my administrative assistant. We're very close and dear friends, and we think alike. I mean, it's terrible. It's almost like husband and wife, if I may be so... unkind to both our wives, whom we love dearly, but we think so much alike that it's that, you know, we sit and we talk and we develop and we tape, and so that we're just so. It's when he writes, it's like I'm speaking out of my mouth most of the time. So, but yes, I don't know of a modern author, really, that Hemingway hasn't affected, a modern successful author that Hemingway hasn't affected to some degree, if not his idealism and his other thing, but certainly his style. His spare style, is an elegant style, is something I think that started a whole generation of writers.
Eric, thanks for your call.
Thanks,
Eric.
Thank you.
Arlington, Massachusetts now. Edward's on the line. Hi, Edward.
Hello. Hello, Senator McCain.
Hi, Edward.
I wanted to, first of all, thank you because I sent an email to a number of congressmen about airport security, and you were the only one who answered, your staff.
Thank you, Edward.
And my question in terms of today's show is I'm curious what you think of George Orwell. George Orwell as a participant in the Spanish Civil War and also as an author.
Well, I think he's one of the great authors in history, and it's interesting the timelessness of some of his books, specifically 1984. But, Edward, you know, one of his great works was the description of the anarchist rebellion in Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War, and it was a great disillusioning experience for him. Remember that, Edward?
Oh, sure. I know Orwell pretty well. If I can just add a comment, which is that I'm a lifelong Democrat, but someone like yourself and your interest in people like Zapata and Orwell and these kinds of issues confuses us and makes us tempted to look elsewhere. So we sometimes wish you would look elsewhere, but, you know, we know where reality lies.
I thank you, Edward.
Okay.
Orwell was a very much of a leftist, I guess would be the best thing to say. And then he went to the Spanish Civil War again. I believe he was wounded, if I recall.
That's correct.
And he saw this anarchist uprising put down with incredible brutality, and it really had a profound and permanent change, and it also, though, made him very, very much concerned about fascism as well, so which is
or totalitarianism in all its forms.
Exactly, and which, please correct me if I'm wrong, because you know him better than I do, was one of the motivating factors in 1984.
Well, 1984 was an amalgam, essentially, where he consciously tried not to put one side or the other in the gun sights, if you want, mm-hmm. but essentially mm-hmm. wanted to show that totalitarianism it can come in many forms and that it tends mm-hmm. to lose whatever idealistic sense it has when it comes to play.
Well, if I may be so bold, remember that I received my education at the United States Naval Academy, not renowned for its deep literary studies. I think that Hemingway will be remembered for his incredible style and his incredible ability to tell a story. I think Orwell will be remembered to a greater degree for his lessons. The reason why we keep reading 1984 is the lesson of 1984 as opposed to the beauty of the prose. So I think maybe that's maybe a difference, a distinction without a difference between the two, but I admire both authors enormously.
Edward, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
To Amesbury, Massachusetts, Ben's joining us. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Dick. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks.
Hey, Ben.
Senator, it's an honor to be on the air with you.
Thank you.
I was reading a book recently that made me think of some of the writings that you've done and also some of the speeches I've heard. I went to a reading where there were two authors reading a new book called Keeping Faith, a Father-Son Story about Love and the United States Marine Corps, and it's just been published. Are you aware of that book, Senator?
No, tell me who wrote it.
It's by Frank Schaefer and his Marine son, John, who's mm-hmm. currently a corporal in the Marine Corps. Kind of unusual for a corporal who's 18 to be writing a book with his dad. His dad is a novelist. But this reading was incredible because it was in a room filled with people who you might describe as the sort of elite of the North Shore, kind of Volvo-driving, higher education-worshipping people. And they were absolutely spellbound by this young Marine standing there in his dress blue uniform, reading his poems and from this wonderful book, Keeping Faith. And I just finished it. I really hope you read it because it showed me that, you know, maybe there's another future greatest generation and that heroism is not dead. And when I read Keeping Faith, I couldn't help but think of you because part of the book talks about the sorrow and the shame the author, the father, felt being the Vietnam generation for not having served and the terrible reception so many vets got coming back. And, you know, the book reminded me of you and also just reminded me to thank you for serving for the rest of us, some of us that weren't there for whatever reason. You know, you were standing in the heat of the day. Thank you.
I thank you, Ben, and I will read it. And by the way, I would like to mention that one of my reasons for friendship and gratitude with John Kerry is because we worked very hard together on normalization of relations between our country and Vietnam. And one of the prime motivations for that was to heal these wounds that were still so open and so deep that existed within our society and a lot of our Vietnam veterans who had not come all the way home. So I thank you, and I will read it, and it sounds like a marvelous story.
Ben, thanks for your call.
It's also a beautifully written book.
Thanks, Ben.
You write in both your books about your fathers,
mm-hmm.
or your father and your grandfather,
mm-hmm.
Four-star admirals both,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken. Their inspiration
yeah.
for you. It,
mm-hmm.
it was a part that came through to me when, in that passage when Robert Jordan, in For Whom the Bell Tolls, is talking about his grandfather, the eagle feathers of the war bonnets that hung on the wall, their plumes slanting, the smoked buckskin smell of the leggings, the shirts, the feel of the beaded moccasins, that wonderful ability has to take you into that child sense of, you know, handling the grandfather's gun, which is what he goes
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
to talk about.
It's a great passage, and it gives us great insight into the Robert Jordan that Hemingway gives us. My father and grandfather were Navy men through and through. They were totally apolitical. I don't think either one of them ever voted and was probably proud of it because they believed in this separation of the military and civilian. Both of them loved the Navy more than anything else, and both of them served in a number of wars. Small item of trivia, my real great hero and role model, of course, is Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt sent the Great White Fleet around the world. An ensign just recently graduated from the Naval Academy on board the USS Oregon was my grandfather and the Great White Fleet, you know. And so serving their country and its causes was their first and foremost desire, and they did it well. Not perfectly, but they did it well.
And we'll come back to that.
Thanks.
When we return after our short break, our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Senator John McCain is my guest. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Senator John McCain. We're talking about his passion for Hemingway, the inspiration that Robert Jordan from the novel For Whom the Bell Tolls has given him, both as a soldier and as a politician. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll go to Brookline, Massachusetts, and Stephen joins us. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Senator McCain, it's an honor, as everyone has said, to be on the phone with you. I'm wondering if you could tell us, what do you think Hemingway would think of our modern methods of war with precision-guided munitions dropped from jets screeching high above and mm-hmm. computer warfare? Is this the kind of warfare that a great writer could inspire people to, you know, fight for?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I never thought about it. But I would think that Hemingway would probably appreciate the precision and minimizing civilian casualties aspect of it. You know, one of the great passages ever written in English literature is his depiction of the retreat at Caporetto in A Farewell to Arms. I mean, it is one of the most incredible stories, and it was a true story. It was a retreat that part of the Italian army in World War I after the Germans and Austrians had attacked them after they'd been attacking entrenched positions for about a year. I think that Hemingway, as much as he gloried in war, was also repelled by the gruesome loss of innocent life associated with war. So because he's my hero, I would have to say with great subjectivity, I hope he would applaud the technology that allows us to minimize civilian casualties, because the great horror of war is the innocent people that are killed. The combatants, it's terrible and it's a tragedy, but it's far worse, the innocent civilians who die. In both world wars, far more innocent civilians died than combatants, and that's the real tragedy, the greatest tragedy of war in my view. So, but it's an interesting question. I'd have to contemplate it, Stephen. Thanks.
Do you think his hero might be the jet pilots or the...
Yeah, I think his hero might be the special forces guy on horseback that was riding around Afghanistan with the laser to illuminate the target for the pilots. Yeah, that's probably who his hero would be.
Thank you.
I thank you, Stephen.
Spanish Civil War, mix of horses and planes, probably the first time, or that they were in warfare like that. Kind of strange.
Indeed. Remember, Robert Jordan was on a horse when the shell hit and the horse fell on him and crushed his leg. But we're getting into real trivia now. Anyway, if you're ever interested in one of the most gripping passages to reread again, the retreat at Caporetto in Hemingway's Farewell to Arms is a remarkable story. Remarkable depiction of a true event.
Stephen, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Madison, Wisconsin. Steve is joining us. Hi, Steve.
Hi, and thanks for an extremely entertaining hour. Senator McCain, again, it is very much an honor to speak to you, and I appreciate your service to our country and wish you so much luck in the future. I was wondering if you could talk about one thing. Hemingway loved the sea so much, and during the Vietnam War, there was one battle that didn't happen in the jungles or in the air, but it did happen on the sea. Could you just take a couple minutes and tell us about the battle on the fire of the USS Forrestal? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I sure would, Stephen.
Where did I read you writing about that? Was that in the new book or in the...
It was in the old book.
In the old book, okay. Sorry.
We were on the Gulf of Tonkin, the USS Forrestal. We'd only been a few days in combat, and by mistake and maintenance error, in other words, a personal error, a rocket fired across the flight deck. We were just getting ready for a launch. Hit, went through the fuel tank of my airplane that I was sitting in, and also shook some bombs off of the wings. A fuel fire ensued. I jumped off the refueling probe of the A4 that I was in, and about 30 to 45 seconds later, bombs started exploding. Young men, usually 18, 19, 20 years old, fought that fire literally hand-to-hand for the next 24 hours. They saved the ship, and they died as brave, with the same courage and bravery that people display in combat, and I'll always be grateful to them. And it was the worst fire in the history of the United States Navy. And we learned a lot from it, obviously. But I'll always remember those brave young men. I had gotten some shrapnel in my leg. I went up to the sick bay, and there was a number of young men terribly burned laying there. And one of them called me over and said, Mr. McCain, I said, yeah, he was a plane captain, the one that takes care of the planes. And he said, Mr. so-and-so, one of the pilots in the squadron, he didn't make it. And I said, oh, no, he made it. He's fine. And he said, thank God, and died. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Thanks, Steve. But I'm proud of the young men who sacrificed for the rest of the 3,000 of us that were on that aircraft carrier.
You quoted someone in your new book about war is not the ugliest thing, and I'm just flipping through my copy trying to remember it. Can you pluck that from your memory?
War is not the
ugliest thing. The ugliest thing is the people who refuse to stand and fight for
exactly.
something.
Who refuse to stand and fight for what they believe in, I think is, if I remember right, I've forgotten, the quote. I was thinking so much about Hemingway, I've forgotten my own quotes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a very pretty thing, face up, war.
No, it's a terrible thing.
Does Hemingway go too far? Straight talk here, Senator. Does Hemingway sometimes go too far in making it a glamorous thing?
I think so. I think he does sometimes. Now, he paints it in stark terms and things like For Whom the Bell Tolls, but I think he... he glamorizes it too, in the respect that he glamorizes the hero who's willing to fight and die. I don't think he paints it any more than there's a passage where this gorilla with four or five gorillas is headed towards meeting Robert Jordan, El Sordo, and he gets runs into some fascists, and they have this horrendous fight, and that's a gruesome thing. You know, it can only repel you. At the end, the fascist officer shoots the one living person and calls for their heads to be cut off. You know, I mean, it's terrible. But I think by glorifying those who participate in war, he then, by association, perhaps glorifies war too much. And, you know, it's the innocents that suffer in war that's so awful about it.
Steve, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Steve.
Going to Jeffersonville, Indiana. Bob is joining us. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Hey,
I think Senator McCain maybe partially answered my question just a second ago. I was a Marine veteran in Vietnam and served at a place called Con Tien.
I know it, yes.
You remember it, huh?
Yes.
During the siege in the fall of 1967, and for me it was a defining period, the month that I was there. It was kind of punctuated by a situation in which a round came in, killed everybody around me, and from that whole experience was a defining moment and a defining period in my life. Did you have a defining period in your life, either being shot down or, as you were talking about, when the round went off on the aircraft carrier? And what impact has it had on the rest of your life as far as being maybe courageous or your mm-hmm. actions in Congress, and particularly related to campaign finance reform and standing up against a lot of special interests? Has it kind of given you the courage, like, I have hit situations in my life, and it's...
Let's let the senator in on this, Bob.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, Bob, and thanks for your service. I know exactly what you're talking about. It increased my fatalism, survival of the Forrestal, survival of crashing three other Navy airplanes, getting shot down the way that I did by getting hit by a surface-to-air missile. But probably the defining moment for me was when the Vietnamese offered me an opportunity to go home early because my father was a very big admiral. And the fact that I was able to refuse it, which, by the way, was driven not by idealism, but by the fact that I didn't think that I should leave my fellow prisoners behind, I think was probably a defining moment because... to make that decision.
That kept you three more years in Vietnam as a prisoner, right? It wasn't like a couple of months.
Yeah, luckily I didn't know it was going to be three more years. But that I think, was the same kind of defining moment you're talking about, in that I stood up for what I believed was right, and I knew at the end, even though I stayed three more years, that was really the right thing to do, because it would have been very, very harmful to those that I left behind. The admiral's son leaves and the rest of them stay. You see what I mean? It was all a propaganda thing. So I think that was the defining moment. Bob, thanks for serving, my friend.
Bob, thanks for calling. Nice to have you on the program. There's a part of the book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, mm-hmm. that I thought I would read and then ask you to perhaps read the end of your book, not
okay.
because, well, there's a similarity okay. to it. There's a kind of music to it that I kind of like. So we have a few minutes left in the program.
Okay.
Maybe I can start by,
okay.
this is, you described the scene better than I can. Robert Jordan's leg has been crushed beyond repair by the horse that came down on him, and he's got one gun and one chance to keep the people from moving up the road. And Hemingway tells it like this. He says, he looked down the hill slope again and he thought, I hate to leave it is all. I hate to leave it very much, and I hope I have done some good in it. I have tried to with what talent I had. Have, you mean. All right, have. I have fought for what I believed in for a year now. If we win here, we will win everywhere. The world is a fine place and worth the fighting for, and I hate very much to leave it. And you had a lot of luck, he told himself, to have had such a good life. You've had just as good a life as grandfather's, though not as long. You've had as good a life as anyone because of these last days. You do not want to complain when you've been so lucky. I wish there was some way to pass on what I'd learned, though. Christ, I was learning fast there at the end.
I did not get to be President of the United States, and I doubt I shall have reason or opportunity to try again. But I've had a good long run, 44 years. I could leave now satisfied that I have accomplished enough things that I believe are useful to the country to compensate for the disappointment of my mistakes. As we finish this book, to my great delight, campaign finance reform passed both houses of Congress and the President signed it into law. He has my gratitude, and I hope the country's. I've had the most legislative successes of my career since I withdrew from the presidential race. It would be a hell of a time to make my exit. But unlike Ted Williams, I'll hate like hell to leave it. This is an extraordinary time to be alive and involved in the affairs of the country. We're not a perfect nation. Our wealth and strength might delude us into thinking that we are, and complacency is our greatest adversary. Challenges unimagined a generation ago command every good citizen's concern and labor. But has there ever been such a nation as ours? We are so prosperous and powerful that I can scarcely imagine how great a civilization we will become and how profoundly we will affect the progress of all humanity. It's worth the fighting for and always will be. My time might be passing, but I'll be grateful for what remains so that I can watch America come ever closer to the ideal she was always intended to be and that I might yet become the man I always wanted to be.
It's not a farewell.
Well, it's hard. You know, you've got to, I think you've got to pause and look around and see what you've done, but most importantly, see what more you can do. And perhaps spend your time, as some great and good men have, motivating other young Americans to embark on a career of public service.
Senator, it's not often that someone sits in the chair that you're in and has every single caller begin their remarks by saying what it is, what an honor it is to speak to you. And it's been a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you. Maybe after they read my book, they will find that I still have a few warts. Thanks for having me on, Dick.
Just a note here, the senator will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at Wordsworth Books at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. That's for listeners in the Boston area. My guest this hour, Senator John McCain, Arizona's senior Republican senator. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Elephant Walk Restaurant, featuring chef Nadza de Montero's innovative menu of Cambodian and French cuisine, offering private dining rooms and off-premise catering for holiday events.